Going to open the Human Services and Rural Health Policy Committee. Good morning and welcome. The very last day of our committee. How about that?
Oh, darn.
But we're going to
8 o'clock a.m.
Yeah, but we have a meeting scheduled. Let's see, 5:30. So if any of you are not doing anything, you may want to drop by again. We're going to have a party then. No, not really. Okay, so we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2987. Heidi McGowan, Heidi, and Beth Unizent. I messed that up, but Beth.
Beth, I'm
resolved. Oh, perfectly clear.
It is.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2987A requires the Child Care Division of the Employment Department to establish rules and registration procedures for school-age recorded programs and defines those programs. It requires the defined programs to register with CCD and perform criminal background checks for all staff and volunteers. It eliminates the requirement that operators and employees be enrolled in the criminal history registry and requires CCD to establish a database of recorded programs. Requires notification of parents and posting information regarding program status. There was a no revenue impact statement issued and a minimal fiscal impact statement issued.
Thank you. Heidi, we start.
Great. Thank you. Chair Morissette and members of the committee, my name is Heidi McGowan. I'm the executive officer of the Commission for Child Care. I'm here on their behalf. Rosetta Wongren, who is the chair of the commission, wasn't able to be here today, so I'll go ahead and just share a few words of her written testimony here. The Commission for Child Care is a body of 18 volunteers appointed by the governor, speaker of the House, and Senate. We're an advisory body regarding the issues of child care. And in 2007, the Child Care Division came to the commission, requested guidance on the working definition of exempt school-age care. The working definition of exempt care has many gray areas because of the variety of programs and facilities available to school-age children in Oregon. For example, some after-school programs may offer activities such as karate, yet also provide a place for children to stay for several hours before and or after class. The Commission for Child Care has a strong responsibility feels that they have a strong responsibility to hear from the citizens of Oregon before recommending changes in legislation. And so we went around the state and held 5 community forums throughout the last 2 years and held an online survey to obtain feedback on this issue. The proposed legislation reflects the results of the community feedback, which was consistently expressed in the community forums. And this proposed legislation has three proposals. One is that it will require all employees and volunteers who have unsupervised contact with children to submit to a background history check. It secondly asks programs to inform parents that they are not licensed by the State of Oregon Child Care Division. And thirdly, to enroll by mail in the Child Care Division database. During this formation of this proposed legislation, the Commission for Child Care worked very closely with partners such as Boys and Girls Club of Oregon, the faith community, summer camps such as YMCA, who offer youth development programs who will be impacted by this. And I just want to call your attention to a letter here from the Boys and Girls Club from Lloyd Toll, who is a consultant to the local Boys and Girls Clubs in Oregon throughout the state of Oregon and who works with 46 Boys and Girls Clubs, which serve over 85,000 children in Oregon ages 6 through 18. And just to want to make a note here of his support, the Boys and Girls Club's support of this concept. He expresses appreciation for the time and the energy the commission has taken to listening to the viewpoints of the private nonprofit youth development organizations to ensure that our communities have safe and positive youth development experiences. I'll stop there. In either case, there's support here. And as a commission, we are here as a resource to you. We look forward to working with you and moving this forward.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Okay. Beth?
Thank you, Senator Morissette and committee members. I'm Beth Unverzot. I'm the director of Oregon After School for Kids, which is a collaboration of state agencies, associations, and programs, statewide programs, that have been meeting for the last 3.5 years, discussing some of the issues that we find in the world of after school. After school programs have really sort of fallen off the track. Early childhood, and the focus has been in creating processes for safety for children that are under the age of 5. And there's sort of been this mindset that if you go to school, everything's taken care of. And the reality is that it's not so. So we really looked at children both ages 5 through 12, which is part of the Commission for Child Care. There are really only two agencies that look at children 5 through 18, and that's Department of Human Services and the world of education. But nobody really is responsible for after-school programs other than the Commission for Child Care, and that's only up to the age of 12. So we've been having a lot of discussions and came to the Commission for Child Care and talked about some of the issues that we've seen within the world of after school. And so exempt care is sort of, this is one of our first steps, because we don't have a handle on who is really caring for children that are, and this is a huge amount of time, you know, before school, after school, summer breaks, sessions. So we have started a survey that we are doing, a statewide survey around after-school programs, to see if we can find who, in fact, is caring for children. And this it's a very complex world, because there has been no regulation. There's really been no public discussion on after-school programming. We're part of a national initiative that there are 38 states that are developing after-school networks. So I'm here to encourage you to support this so that we can begin to establish some basis of safety for the children that are being cared for. Thank you.
Okay. Questions? how few children have to be involved in a program if there's a babysitting situation for a child after school?
Primarily, after school programs, there are really no guidelines. I mean, unless they're licensed child care, there are no guidelines.
Okay, now are you talking licensed then?
There are licensed, unlicensed. Okay. It's just a plethora of programs that. So, Child Care Division knows who is licensed.
Yeah.
Nobody else knows who else is caring for children.
Boys so
in exempt programs.
Boys and Girls Club, are they licensed?
They are not licensed.
Okay.
Y's are licensed, but there are really only 15 Boys and Girls Clubs with 47 sites. There are a huge number of other kinds of programs that are being run by nonprofits.
Churches?
Some are churches.
And licensure is not required for after school?
Licensure is not required.
And what is your ultimate goal?
I think an understanding of the issues that face any program.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't matter who you work for, you have similar issues. You have issues of professional development for the field. So we've had a lot of discussions around what are the things that people need to know who work with children, so core competencies for the field. We've had discussions around what are the needs of the people and the programs who operate. We currently we're providing technical assistance to all of the 21st century programs, which are federally funded programs, and so there's an ebb and flow that happens in after school. The reality is that 81% of Oregon families work and need a place for their children to be, and we've also seen a huge fall off of programs for children ages 11 through 16. So basically children are raising themselves. They have nothing to do when it's after school.
Okay, the Child Care Division of the Employment Department shall adopt rules establishing fees and certification, registration, and recording. Right?
Kathleen, do you want
Chair Morissette, and members of the committee, I've asked Kathleen Hines from the Child Care Division to come up and respond to some of the technical questions.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, my name is Kathleen Hines. I'm the Legal and Compliance Manager with the Child Care Division. And I'm sorry, could you repeat your question?
Well, Section 2 on page 3 says Child Care Division of the Employment Department shall adopt rules establishing fees and certification, registration, and recording under ORS.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, as you've heard from Heidi and Beth, the general purpose of this is to kind of get a handle on those programs that are not required to be licensed. Many after-school programs are, but there are those programs out there that don't meet the criteria for licensure. So what this would the purpose of this would be to require those programs to, we didn't use the word register because we use that already for so many other things, to become recorded with the Child Care Division, pay the $20 fee to cover the cost of that, so there'd be a neutral fiscal impact. So then we would have an idea, the Commission would have an idea of what programs are out there serving school-age child or school-age children, whether they be, you know, a karate program, again, that provide, you know, allows the kids to stay around until their parents come to get them, or the Boys and Girls Club, for example, or church-based programs or community-based programs. So that's, it's a minimal requirement of just requiring those folks that are involved in these programs to have a background check, then to register so that everyone knows who's out there, and again, to notify the parents that they're not licensed or have that level of oversight.
Okay. Now, we're in Springfield, City of Springfield, where I'm from. There is a great program, after-school program with the Parks Department and the school district and so on and so forth, and they're probably licensed. Where would they fall under this?
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, our statute has an exemption for programs operated by local government entities or school districts, so they're not required to be licensed, and they would not be required to be recorded under this statute. We would encourage them to, but they would not be required to.
Okay. And church groups are not licensed.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, some would be if they do child care and meet the standards that are there in place for licensure. Mm-hmm. If they don't, no, they're not currently required to be licensed. They would be required to go through, have their folks go through background checks and get recorded with the division.
Okay. Yes. Senator Telfer.
Thank you. Is there... if an organization deals with children under the age of 12, mm-hmm. as well as over the age of 12, because they're dealing with under age 12, do they fall under certain regulations that they would be applying to over 12 anyway? Is there duplication here?
Yeah. Chair Morissette, Senator Telfer, members of the committee, most child care programs go up through age 12 because that's... the tax laws are tied. People can only take the child care tax credit through 12. So not surprisingly, they find other arrangements for their children as they get a little older. In licensed programs, unless the young person is there as a helper or something like that, generally don't have that mix of age group of over 12 and under 12, or they're very separate, isolated programs, and the program for children under 12 or 12 and under, I'm sorry, is licensed, and then the program for the older children would not be.
Well, thank you. I'll use the example of Boys and Girls Club. Mm-hmm. You know, they deal with a lot of different ages, so mm-hmm. they have background checks for their personnel because they're dealing with under 12.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, they've already, you know, they already have established a lot of these things anyway, so they would not be required to do something in addition.
Chair Morissette, Senator Telfer, members of the committee, they would be required, they do have background checks in place, and so under this legislation they'd be required to become recorded with the Child Care Division and post a notice that they're not licensed. And as Heidi McGowan testified, they're fully in support of this concept.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Other questions?
So what about like the private clubs that have volleyball and gymnastics,
mm-hmm.
do they fall under this also? I know there have been actual child abuse, sexual abuse, in a couple of gymnastic programs in the metro area, up in the Portland area. So would they, are they under anything, or would they be falling underneath this?
Do you want me to answer?
Go ahead.
Chair Morissette, Senator Monsanderson. The legislation was drafted to exclude those programs that are exclusively athletics, in the sense that, you know, if there's club volleyball or club basketball that meets, you know, and practices a certain number of hours a week, those would not be considered school-age recorded programs under this. If it's a program that, for example, has that activity and then the youth stay around or have some other kind of supervised activity, they would fall within this. But if it's strictly a sporting program that we, you know, that's commonly recognized as volleyball, you know, and they go to, the kids go to practice 2 hours a day, 4 days a week, that would not be included in this.
It just seems to me, follow-up, mm-hmm. yeah, just seems to me, obviously they don't meet the requirements here, but
mm-hmm.
it would seem that anyone who works with children should have a background check, no matter what. But I guess parents don't think about that when they're pretty trusting when they take their kids to a gymnastics class, thinking that everything is,
mm-hmm.
everyone is on the up and up.
Well, there are dance classes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there are music rehearsal groups mm-hmm. or groups. There are athletic groups that meet, clubs, and so on. And you're not including necessarily every single group in this bill at the present time. Is that right? You're building. Yes.
Chair Morrison, members of the committee, the intent of the Commission for Child Care, which really came from the community feedback, is to separate out activities that are singly focused, such as a dance class
okay.
or a music class,
okay.
to youth development programs, which are typically longer hours of a day and many more days in a week. So there was an
okay.
attempt to separate
okay.
those and clarify the
yeah.
difference between child care-related activities and enrichment activities.
Okay. Thank you.
Just a one other follow-up.
Yes.
Have we had any proof or that these youth development activities have had problems with the types of people that care for them, or is this just mainly wanting to know where they are?
I can take that. Senator Monsanderson and members of the committee, this proposed legislation came out of community response saying there should be some level of oversight. It didn't come from any negative experience. It came from citizens saying there should be some level of oversight, at a minimum a background check for individuals. And then for the enrollment piece, because we don't know which programs are out there, it becomes a communication tool where we can provide resources to individuals who are providing youth development activities.
Senator Morris said, I'd also like to respond. I think there's just a lot of confusion. What's child care licensed and what's not? And a lot of parents assume that a program is licensed. So part of the trying to create some sense of understanding for parents of what it is they're actually enrolling in and who it is that's caring for their children is by actually having somebody post something that says, you know, this is not licensed. So then a parent's awareness is, what is licensed? What's that mean? And at a very base minimum, to make sure that people are background checked, because they're not currently background checked.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this background check, FBI check, or LEDS check?
Senator Cruz, Chair Morissette, members of the committee, this leaves it up to that individual organization to determine what kind of background check they want to do on their employees and volunteers. So most likely it will be with a local police department or...
There's a big difference, yeah. Cost-wise.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
One other thing, Mr. Chair. We passed a bill that changes the name of the Criminal History Registry, so there need be some conforming. Something happened at some point in time, I would think.
Yes. But. Yeah, Senator Cruzzi, it's going to be changed to the Central Background Registry, so we'll have to conform that.
That's right, we did do that. Okay, other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Others wishing to testify? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2987.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2987 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2987 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I'm going to oppose this bill. I think this is overkill. I helped create, I was president of the board that helped create the Boys and Girls Club of Douglas County. We have a relationship with the school district. It's a very good relationship. My daughter is involved in a lot of programs, and quite honestly, I fully trust my wife to be able to tell whether it's a good program or not. At some point in time, unless our goal is to have the state have its hands in every activity that goes on everywhere at any point in time, we need to say enough's enough, and I think this oversteps.
Okay. Other comments?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I feel a little bit differently in that I feel any program that is working with children should require a background check. Even my church preschool, before we let them in our church take care of our children while their parents are in the service, we require background checks. I think this is actually a step in the right direction in wanting to require everyone who works with children to have a background check.
Yes, Senator Telfer.
Well, I do believe that children over the age of 12 need to have supervision and good guidance. But again, it seems to be a level of regulation that another fee, another process. I would imagine my practice is predominantly nonprofits now, and whether they're required to do background checks or not, they're dealing with kids. They do it. This is automatically just because of the liability exposure they have. So, it just seems like it's just another layer of regulation and fees and a process that somebody that's wanting to deal with kids over the age of 12 after school may not know this exists and has to jump through an awful lot of hoops. Just one more fee, one more regulation.
And one more safe child.
Maybe.
Anyway, other comments? I guess my feeling is that you can't tell by looking at a person whether or not you're who they are, what they are. In fact, some of the most trustworthy people are con artists, and those are the ones who rely on coming across as trustworthy and so on. So I think a background check is probably a good idea for these particular programs. And the fact that there was a lot of work done around the state, gathering information and getting feedback and so on, I think warrants what we're doing. So, other comments?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that it's a shame that we need it. That I guess I can't let this pass without saying that. There was a time when we didn't have to worry about so many predators with our children, and the children led a lot freer and happier circumstances. However, obviously that's not the case today, and so I think that protecting children is of a lot of essence. I sympathize, as Senator Cruz does, with the fact that we have to have government involved in everything. I also agree with Senator Kelford that if you are going to have a program, it just is prudent that you do background checks. You would think that everybody would do it. Obviously, that's not the case. So I think that the protection of children just has to override my resistance to so much government, which I truly am to the point in this session of thinking we really need to start minimizing where government is. But in this case, I would support this.
Other comments? Okay. Would you call the roll, please?
Senator Monson.
Aye.
Senator Clinton.
Aye.
Senator Selman.
No.
No.
Chair Morrison.
Aye. Okay, House Bill 2987 passes, and I will carry the bill. Okay, our next item on the agenda is... we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3279. Okay, nobody is... Oh, Megan, okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3279A makes provider base rates and add-on payments mandatory in collective bargaining for adult foster care home providers that receive fees or payments from a public employer. We have received a -3 amendment on this bill, which adds an emergency clause, which would be effective July 1st of 2009. We've received a no revenue impact statement on that amendment. We have not received a fiscal impact statement on the amendment.
Okay. Megan, would you introduce yourself, please?
Sure. Chair Morissette, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Megan Moyer. I'm with the Service Employee International Union, Local 503. And House Bill 3279A has come from the House with work from the Governor's Office, the Department of Human Services, the Department of Administrative Services, and SEIU to clarify language around how we will bargain over the Medicaid rate paid to adult foster care providers. This issue arose during collective bargaining based on the fact that in statute, adult foster care providers, for the purposes of collective bargaining, fall under the Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act, which is PECBA. And PECBA clearly states that you can bargain over any monetary compensation, but does not give a framework for a provider rate or a Medicaid rate, because most public employees don't receive a Medicaid rate. So we needed to create a framework in which we would bargain rates. So the language that's being added, which is bargaining includes, was not limited to provider base rates and add-on payments, came from conversations with the Department of Human Services and the Governor's Office as the framework in which we would bargain over. The base rate is the set amount that somebody gets for any client. And then add-ons are payments that are given when a client is assessed and has additional need beyond a typical client would need. They may need a higher staffing ratio. They may have specialized health care issues that need to be met with to go beyond what a typical client would. The assessment for that client is not collectively bargained. That is entirely between the Department of Human Services and the client. All that would be collectively bargained is if it is assessed that person needs this additional support level, what that reimbursement for that would be, is what would be collectively bargained. The -3 amendment is to correct a drafting error on my part that I forgot to add an emergency clause and did not notice it until after it passed the House. The purpose for that is that we are currently in collective bargaining and would want this framework to apply to our current bargaining session.
Oh, here we are. Now, hold on, because we just...
Mr. Chair, we just received the fiscal.
Again, this is another bill that comes forward, and yes, it won't affect the current service levels, but it could affect later current service levels. Mm-hmm.
Chair Morissette, Senator Monson Anderson, we have already bargained our first contract
and provider rates were in it. We didn't use the base rate add-on formula. It was just a set increase on top of it. So this is not a significant change. Rates are already bargained. This creates the framework of how they will be bargained. So as far as any collective bargaining process may increase or decrease costs, that is true, but it's consistent from with current practice.
Other comments?
Let's,
yes,
Mr. Chair,
Senator Bridger.
Would you talk about the unfilled positions and the double filled positions in the reporting?
Where's the fiscal?
Senator Morissette, Senator Bridger, I think we may be talking about the wrong bill. This is related to adult foster care collective bargaining.
Right.
And these are provider, they are not employees of the state. They are independent small business owners and operators who provide care for seniors and people with physical disabilities, developmental disabilities via the Department of Human Services and Medicaid.
Mm-hmm.
So there are no filled or double filled positions.
Okay, this is House Bill 2123.
No, we're on 3270.
All right, I've got the wrong bill in front of me. That's why.
Okay.
I got this. How? Why would that be in there? Okay. There you go.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Senator
Bridger.
Thank you.
Senator Telfer,
well, I'll be...
you'll be Senator Telfer.
Okay, I'll be Senator Telfer today.
Good choice.
Great senator. So, if a foster care is providing a service that is reimbursed by Medicare, Why do you need to bargain the rate? I mean, it's based on what Medicare is going to reimburse them, isn't it?
Senator Morissette, Senator Telfer. Actually, no. Provider rates are there is some question about what is. We have collective bargaining rights. It's currently in statute, so we have the right to bargain a contract. In that, we have, because we're under Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act, we have the right to negotiate any monetary compensation. And when we look at a provider rate in total, it's more than just the cost of feeding somebody, the cost of housing. It's also a wage for an individual. They make their living this way. They may hire help in their adult foster home, so they may have employees. It's an all-inclusive rate. And the idea around this language is it did create those questions of what do we negotiate over, what is just a reimbursement, because there's wages and the compensation. This is a business. And that's why we came up with this language. All the parties got together and felt like this was the best way of addressing it in a whole, if you will, because it is a complicated. Medicaid rate is an all-inclusive rate.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you. I'm looking at the last sentence of the fiscal impact statement. Do you have that?
No.
I don't. Yeah.
This is...
It says basically further, depending on the timing and the outcome of the collective bargaining, the department may need to request additional funding or propose offsetting budget reductions in other reimbursement rates or program service if the department is unable to accommodate the resulting fiscal impact within its legislatively approved budget. To me, that says then that reimbursement rates, and I think maybe the department needs to be here to explain that if for some reason this increases the rates for whatever you're bargaining for, that they will actually have to decrease their rates to other providers such as nursing facilities or residential care or assisted living.
Okay, Mary, would you come up? Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Morissette and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Gear. I'm the administrator for the Office of Licensing and Quality of Care in the Department of Human Services, Seniors and People with Disabilities Division.
Chair Morissette and Senator Mona Sanderson, you had a question about the long-range impact potentially on rates. As Megan testified, we have completed the first year of collective bargaining, and are currently in the process of our second year, and had last year had bargained a $260 rate increase across the board for a lot of our community-based providers, including foster homes. The potential long-term financial impact would indeed be subject to the collective bargaining process, and so whatever the base rate structure and then the add-ons would be negotiated at the bargaining table is what we would put forward as the rate structure. This gets a little bit confusing in that the department, by state statute and by federal law, retains the authority to come up with a rate methodology. We have to report to the federal government what our rate methodology is. And so with that authority, we would bring that to the bargaining table and, you know, present that as our proposal. What's a little bit different about this and what is really essentially uncharted waters is that the proposals at the bargaining table are then subject to binding arbitration. And so we would put forward our proposals, what our rate methodology is. If we were unable to come to agreement with the union, then it would potentially go to binding arbitration.
And binding arbitration is they choose one package versus the other, and if they choose in favor of the unions, then we would be required to pay that, and therefore the money would need to be found somewhere. And I guess where I'm going with this, Mr. Chair, is I take a look at the differences between what we've had in our mental health system. And there's such a discrepancy between state-employed salaries and places like Trillium and Albertina Kerr, and we have developed such a wide range, and so they get trained in these other places, and then they come to the state because they get better rates and benefits, which I wish we could pay everyone equally, and I don't know if this would be the same situation or not.
Senator Mona Sanderson, these are not state employees. They are I would not say they're equivalent because every provider type is different, but they are entirely separate entities from the state, and actually historically, and Mayor can speak to this, are one of the most cost-effective community-based care settings that people who need a 24-hour setting can be in. But they are not state-operated. They do not operate differently. All adult foster care providers are equal here. They are all private entities and are negotiating. And the reason I think I appreciate what Mary had to say around why it's important to put in the framework is because if we can agree upon the framework, we go in, hopefully don't need to go to binding arbitration. Nobody hopes that we have not yet gone into binding arbitration with any of our care provider contracts. But if we did, if we have an agreed upon statutory framework for those rates, we don't have that issue where the state puts across one rate methodology, the union puts across another, and an arbitrator who does not work with CMS and does not understand Medicaid rates would be making a decision on that. It's much better if we could agree upon that framework going in.
Other,
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
A point of clarification from Mary, because I was writing and thinking something else. Did you say there was a methodology that state and federal that you would utilize to come to the table to begin with that could be superseded, overrided?
Chair Morissette and Senator Telfer, we're required by federal law to have a methodology, so
right.
we currently have one. And then in the last legislative session, we received direction from you to develop a new acuity-based rate methodology, and we did that and have presented on that in the interim and this session in our Ways and Means presentation. And that included foster home providers as well as the rest of our community-based care system. And so we have an
implemented that, and given the fiscal situation, didn't receive, probably won't receive the okay to go ahead with that full scale. But that was our proposed methodology that did include foster homes. So I would imagine then that that's the methodology we would take to the bargaining table, although certainly SEIU and foster home providers were a part of the work group that developed this methodology. And if for some reason we weren't able to come to agreement, then it potentially could go to binding arbitration, and the arbitrator would decide one or the other of the proposals that were on the table.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So we already have a methodology. We have not been able to implement it because of the fiscal impact of that methodology.
Chair Morissette and Senator Telfer, we already have a methodology because we have to have one. We have a proposed methodology we'd like to move toward, to replace the current one. And we may not be able to do that because of the fiscal impact.
Thank you.
Senator Morissette, Senator Telfer, around the rate methodology, this language actually came from the Department of Human Services, was negotiated, but this is in keeping with the direction in which they want to go with methodology. It is a process that was compromised on how we wanted to do it, because the methodology that the Department of Human Services worked under was before collective bargaining, and therefore it did not take in the process of providers negotiating. And so this is a way of making both an acuity-based rate setting, which the department wants to move toward, compatible with a collective bargaining process. And it's a compromise language, but it does fit in with the direction the department wants to go, where a higher acuity client would have the add-ons and therefore would be a higher rate than a lower acuity client, which would probably just be the base rate. So it's in keeping with the direction the department wants to go, but still allow for a framework of collective bargaining.
Okay.
Is that, I'd like to hear the response from the department.
Chair Morissette and Senator Mona Sanderson, this is language that was negotiated with the governor's office and agreed to by the governor's office and run by the department. Thank you.
Okay. Now, getting back to the fiscal indeterminate, minimal, what?
Especially with the emergency clause.
Senator Mona Sanderson, Senator Morissette, members of the committee, this does not change that collective bargaining deals with rates. We already negotiated in our first contract a rate increase. This does not change that. This changes the framework in which we talk about rates. But to say that this is a new fiscal impact, it's not, because collective bargaining already exists for these workers. Their rates can go up, they can go down. It's indeterminate, because with any collective bargaining process, you don't know what the outcome is, but it's not new. It's an existing question that remains with collective bargaining.
Any response to that, Mary?
Chair Morissette, Megan is right in that we have agreed to collectively bargain rates. We've had discussions about whether that's rate methodology, whether it's particular rates or not. And I would simply say that, the department does have some concerns about the language, and they're really captured well by the statement in the fiscal impact from the Legislative Fiscal Office for the A. Engrossed bill.
Okay. Other comments? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Others wishing to testify? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 3279.
Mr. Chair, I'm curious about whether we want to add the emergency clause. I'd like a little discussion on that.
Okay.
That makes it effective now. Actually, I don't think this bill is necessary. I think these issues can be bargained. I'm just a little concerned about the potential impact. But it's your call. I'm willing to make.
Let's ask Megan. Patty, did you have any comments to make at all? No, you're just listening. but look like you're posed ready to.
Senator Morissette, Senator Cruz, the emergency clause is important, and it should have been in the original bill and was an oversight on my part in drafting. But the reason why it's necessary is because if this statute does not go into effect until the first of the year, and we are unable to come to an agreement, although I'm hopeful that we will be able to, and it does go to binding arbitration, the framework will not exist in binding arbitration, and therefore the arbitrator, neither of us are bound by this agreement. And so that's the purpose, is that it would apply to this collective bargaining process and not, especially since we've reached an agreement and it is agreed upon, we would like that to be in place for this bargaining.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, it's just the fact that there's already a framework in place. The federal government has set that out, and I know this is an agreement, but not all agreements are necessarily the right thing to do. I guess my thought is, if we don't put the emergency clause on, we'd have the opportunity to see how this worked without this addition before it happened. So.
Okay. I would like to do the emergency clause. What other comments?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll make the motion. We'll see how it flies.
Okay.
I move the A3 amendment to House Bill 3279.
Senator Cruz moves the A3 amendment to House Bill 3279. Discussion.
Mr. Chair, I'll be voting against the amendment.
Okay.
For previously stated reasons.
Okay. Other discussion?
Well, Mr. Chair, when I take a look at the fiscal, I am very concerned about having an emergency clause because I'm not sure what the real impact is. We didn't really have any statement from the department on how they feel about the emergency clause. And since they're in the middle of bargaining right now, and then they would be able to then use this, I don't have enough information. I'm sorry.
Well, it looks like we don't have other comments.
I think they've made good points, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Would you withdraw your motion and we won't do the emergency clause? Or do we want to go ahead and vote on it?
Ms. Chair, I'll withdraw my motion.
Okay. So the motion is withdrawn. Okay.
Now, Ms. Chair, I will move House Bill 3279 to the floor with a due pass.
Okay. Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3279 to the floor with a due pass. The emergency clause is removed. That should.
Sure, it just wasn't added.
No, it wasn't added. Well, it was your withdrew your motion to emergency clause. So there is not an emergency clause. Okay. Discussion.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I just really have concerns here. I think there's already a structure in place. I think this adds confusion to it, and I'm not. I will not be supporting this.
Okay. Would you call the roll, please?
Aye.
Senator Berger.
Aye.
Senator
Shelton.
No.
No.
Chair
Marston. Aye. Okay, House Bill 3279 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and I will carry the bill. We're going to do a public hearing on House Bill 2144. I think we have individuals here to testify. So we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2144.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2144A was originally heard on the 6th of May. It instructs the Department of Education, Oregon Youth Authority, DHS and State Commission on Children's and Families to take part in developing an integrated system of care to facilitate a planning process for youth at risk of developing emotional, behavioral, or substance abuse-related needs, utilizing their families and community and natural supports to provide a flexible group of services in a customized plan that reflects the youth and families' needs, values, and preferences. Directs that plan goals and strategies be tied to observable or measurable indicators of success, and directs that agencies implement the wraparound initiative to the extent practical. Allows agencies to combine funding sources and seek federal approval or waiver, and establishes an advisory committee to report the progress to the legislature. Defines in detail family, family-run organizations, identified population, partner agency, services and supports, system of care, and wraparound as it pertains to the goals of House Bill 2144A, and it establishes core values and principles of the wraparound initiative. It identifies implementation factors to be in place by 2015 and permits agencies to adopt rules in collaboration for implementation of the wraparound services. There was a no revenue impact statement issued and a minimal fiscal impact statement issued.
Thank you. Kristen Anderson and Danielle Vanderoy.
Hi, I'm Danielle Vanderkoy from Umatilla County.
Okay.
I'm a parent.
Go ahead.
I started out as foster care, and we did it for 5 years. We took in some difficult children. We had a blast learning DHS system, and we got heavily involved with education and learning as much as we could to care for the children in our home. Come 3 years ago, we had heard about a little munchkin who was getting placed from home to home and is serving on the local and state and some national level committees. I was very excited to help support the different families that this little girl had been involved with. Unfortunately, our home was full at the time. As I got to dig in a little bit deeper, we were able to finally have this little girl into our home. And what had happened was, I'll begin with when she was born, this child has is mentally retarded. She's 5 years old currently. When she was born, she was in the both of her parents had care providers. The mother had 5 hours of care a day, and they were not, the care providers were not able to care for her, for the child's particular needs. So even though there were abuse allegations that were going on, they were not able to care for this particular child. Finally, the child did come into DHS care. When we got this child, we began right away gathering information on how to help her, and we have had many doors that were shut on trying to, one of which was, this was a child that had a history of post-traumatic stress disorder, feeding issues, as well as the mental retardation that was not identified at that time. So as we were trying to find somebody that could help us to identify the behaviors that we were having, we couldn't find anybody that was capable of helping her. So we then proceeded to get an open card so that we could travel from Umatilla County to locally to OHSU to find somebody who was able to help her. It took us at least 4 months to get that the card opened. We finally got the card open. We were under a six-month window that we had. During that six-month time, we were very excited to agree to work with our local mental health, hoping that our local mental health would be able to assist her and learn from her for other kids that were coming in with her history, as well as work with OHSU providers, hoping to make this work. And unfortunately, due to the turnovers, we were only during about a seven-month period, we were only able to have 3 visits with a provider and the high turnovers. So then, therefore, this child in the process then got identified as a DD. We certify our home as a DD foster home. during that time, we were continuing to search for somebody to help us with some of the behaviors that we were having. In the meantime, as we were also in the progress of wanting to adopt this child, we were looking in our county for what can we do to help, because we were getting a lot of advice that there's not services here in the area. Maybe we should look at finding a different home somewhere else that can provide her needs. What can we do? Although when you look at all of her psych evals and all of the different recommendations, it was very clear that she was forming an attachment to us. It took us 6 months to get her to allow us to just rock her. She was a headbanger, and so it was a very ongoing thing. Once we entered into, at the time we were receiving $1,000 foster care rate, that's a special rate for this child. They, even though some of the behaviors were smearing feces and we were vomiting every time we were getting in the car because of the trauma, because of attachment issues, so and we were also, we had enrolled her in the ESD program, and because of her separation anxieties from us, she was not able to sustain the classroom. So we found somebody, we paid $8 an hour at 15-minute intervals to be taken away from us, and then come back, and then take away and come back. It was very successful. We were able to get her back into the classroom and be very successful at that. When we entered into the DD arena, we were, I was a little bit set back, because in our family's hearts, we were, we looked at her more as our child than we were as in the foster. At that point, we were definitely moving forward to the adoptive state. But we stepped into the DD thinking that we were going to get more resources. We were going to be able to have a behavior specialist come into our home.
Now, this is, you're going to get to the wraparound.
Yes, thank you. I will. Basically, what I'm saying is every single door that we had was closed. With the DD services, even though we had the $2,000 cash moving up, we could not take that cash and pay out OHSU because of the mental health system and the local and the local area and the state level. So what has happened is when we're navigating, we have ESD, we have DD services, we have Department of Human Services, we have all these things that all have different demands from this one particular child. And the ability to be able to provide that care and to open up the funds just is not working. So even if we qualify for Head Start, Head Start's not able to fully care for her because of her developmentally. So then she gets pushed over to ESD. They're only able to provide a certain amount of hours for a certain amount of things. So I'm just kind of wanted to give you a little bit of a background of why it's important.
Okay. Good. Why don't you wait right there and we'll come back.
Thank you.
Hello, Chair Morissette and members of the committee. My name's Kristen Anderson, and I'm a parent of a child who has significant mental health and developmental disabilities, and I also am a curriculum coordinator for Oregon Family Support Network, and recently was working on as part of the project team for the Governor's Wraparound Initiative, which for this legislation kind of stems from that work. Danielle's just given us a great example of part of why this legislation's needed. Even with the Children's Systems Change Initiative helping to coordinate care for high-needs children, there are still a lot of barriers, and our agencies remain siloed, and this legislation will give authority to the agencies to be able to break down some of those barriers so we can truly have more effective, more efficient care for our children and our families. And this is using money we have now. This is everything Danielle was talking about was the way programs exist in certain agencies, and it would be using that money in a more effective and efficient manner that produces better outcomes for our families. I know this spring with my son, we recently had a similar type of thing. Very simple, not dramatic. He wanted to do track. That was it. He needed to have an aide to be able to do that. The school district was having a hard time being flexible to be able to provide an aide during that time. We had hours approved to get a mentor through another agency and service, but they don't provide the mentor. We had to find it. And the work I had to do in coordinating between them and the school and everything just to find someone to be able to go to this young man so he could participate in track is just one very simple thing that was very burdensome and doesn't even begin to include the other agencies we deal with, appointments we go to, and all of that. So these are just a couple examples. Our system has been heading in the right direction, but without legislation, without the authority to break down some of those barriers that are in the way, we're not going to be able to move much past beyond the success we've had so far. We have had success, and we can see great outcomes for youth who've been involved in the wraparound process as a form of care. To just think of how much better it could be if agencies were actually able to talk more freely with each other, share funds to be more efficient with how they use them, be able to cooperate better and not have families run ragged trying to keep track of all the different appointments and plans and things that they have to. I guess that's all I wanted to add right now. I also have here Dr. Sargina Budin, who's an associate professor from the Pediatrics of OHS, couldn't be here today and asked me to submit testimony for her. And this is just emails from families who couldn't be here but wanted to be here to let you know how important this legislation is.
Thank you. if you could, you know, give them to the secretary. Jane Ellen, would you come up, please? Did you have anything else you wanted to add? Yeah, okay, thank you. Anyone else wishing to testify? Okay. Why don't you come up? Yeah. And if you would come up. Okay. Yeah, okay. Why don't you go ahead first?
Okay.
And Jane Ellen.
Chair Morissette and members of the committee, my name is Adriana Rickard. I'm from Multnomah County, and my son Isaiah received services from Wraparound Oregon Early Childhood Project. I had been parenting before I had my son and graduated from Portland State University working in child and family studies. I had been staff in a residential treatment facility with Child Protective Services at DHS, among many other programs for at-risk youth and children with special needs. When my son was born, his special needs started immediately with a feeding issue where he became borderline failure to thrive due to a sensory integration disorder where looking at smelling or seeing food, even pictures, would make him vomit profusely. So from the age of 6 months on, we entered many, many different systems in order to get him help. It started at OHSU and the feeding clinic, and it worked all the way into 20 to 30 hours of appointments a week for my family, the trauma that it caused to his sibling and myself, because we were then dealing, as he got older, with severe behavior issues and other developmental disability issues. And even as a professional who would help families navigate the system and provided services previous to having my child, I ended up not being able to go back to work on public assistance since I graduated from Portland State. And for the past 7 years, I was at home caring for him and attending appointments and making sure that he could get the intensive services he needed before he reached kindergarten, because I knew how important that was. What it turned into was me being very depressed, his brother having no support, as I was exhausted to the point of almost no return. And I fell into a deep depression and was still able to care for my child, but I had, you know, nothing left for myself. The system I found to be very shaming and blaming to me as a parent, even though I had some of the same qualifications as the professionals we sought help from. And at the height of our activities there, we had three different diagnoses that the treatment plans for those were telling us three different things to do. One said it's a behavior issue, you need to work on, you know, rewards and consequences and take them to a therapist and the sensory stuff will go away. The ESD community said, no, it's a sensory integration disorder, and if you help them integrate this neurological difference, the behaviors will go away. And then the third party said, no, this is an adjustment / attachment issue, and if you work on the trauma that caused that initially, then the behaviors will go away. So I was talking to this therapist, and I said, well, which one do I do? And she said, well, it really doesn't matter. And I said, yes, it does, because it's like, what came first, the chicken or the egg? In my parents' intuition, I knew what was going on. But it was really confusing because not only did it look like I wasn't participating in a lot of people's treatment plans, I was, you know, we were pulled between these systems. So a friend of mine invited me to be on her wraparound Oregon team. And after the first meeting, was the first girl in the wraparound Oregon early childhood grant, you know, history in Multnomah County. And I just saw that this is exactly what we'd been missing, the coordination, the conversation, the, you know, no duplicating services, that everybody was able to sit at the table with my family driving the agenda so that there were no double standards or conflicting treatment plans and that everybody got to hear the same information at once. And what it did, in short, because I know other people want to speak, is we were able to navigate the system successfully because I had the support of professionals, family members, and our service providers all working for common goals in our family. It restored my hope because I found the truth to be the system is broken, my family wasn't, and that we were not receiving the supports or services that we needed because of the barriers between the systems, and that I was able to be an advocate for my family like I had been before, but because of the severity of these behaviors and the trauma of the whole, you know, raising a child with special needs, it had set me back. So today my son is in kindergarten. He's at the zoo today on a field trip. He's in Spanish immersion. 90% of his day is spent in speaking Spanish, and he's getting really, really good at it. Initially, when he was in Head Start and early Head Start, he would run from the teacher. He wasn't able to be in the classroom without me. We had a four-month transition of weaning him off me. He breastfed till he's four. He didn't potty train till he's four and a half. And now, today, the teacher said he is number one in his class. He is behaviorally absolutely manageable, has made friends, and on top of that all, he really likes going to school and feels successful. And I'm back at work. I work for the Oregon Family Support Network now, and through our journey had found an agency to work for. So I urge you to pass this bill and to remember that this is like the best time ever for families to get the support that they need, and without wraparound's process of bringing everyone together to work collaboratively, it will not happen, and people will continue to get lost in the system. Thank you.
Thank you. Would you introduce yourself, please?
My name is Zach Anderson Clint. I'm a son of Chris Anderson. Okay. And I was not going to speak today, Senator, Morissette and the members of the committee. I had the testimony in the House committee earlier for this bill, and I wasn't planning on speaking today because I was thinking of just listening and going to school. But I have some things to say, I think you should get a chance to hear a youth speak and how it affects the people of this bill. And here I go. And I have been hospitals and residential treatment for a long time, and I do much better at home. Living at home, I know it's hard for all the adults and organizations to help me, but it's just no fair to me, really. But to the House, to help me, because rules get in the way of things, take a long time for me to get better, even though stuff is not right, really, for me. So it's really not good for me to do what I need to do if there's too many strictness or stuff that won't work. So I just hope this bill will pass and hope that we can do stuff to help the community, like people like me. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Questions? Comments? Okay.
Chair Morissette, Jane Ellen White, and members of the committee, Jane Ellen White, Governmental Affairs Manager for Addictions and Mental Health Division. I didn't have any testimony today, but would be happy to answer any questions. I don't know if there are other family members who haven't had a chance to testify today or members of the organizations that support the bill.
Okay. Yeah, there are a few. Okay.
So I'll step back and come back and answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Would you come up? And Miss, would you also come up?
I'm not a family member. I'm an agency person.
That's fine. If you want to testify, that's fine. Go ahead.
Chair Morissette, committee. My name is Jamie Farish. I'm the executive director for Oregon Family Support Network and a family member of two children with emotional and behavioral challenges. And I wanted to just testify for a minute and let you know that I move forward with the voices of many, many families across the state who could not be here today. But just to talk a minute about why this bill needs to be passed, and I think so far what you've heard is you've heard the power of wraparound and some of the experiences that family members have had, that this is a process that works for us, that gets our kids out of institutions and all those different things. But what I'm not sure you heard quite loudly enough that I just want to kind of drive home here is that this bill is important because we are running into barriers around delivering the services that families need and using this wraparound process in communities across Oregon. Oregon prides itself on having individual county control and being creative and really creating things in the communities that work for people. But what's happened on the other side of that around families with wraparound is that when we move from county to county or place to place, that we have really a different world each place that we go, that things are done differently. People work together differently. So you might be able to get some wraparound services if you fall in the right age category in Portland. But if I move somewhere else, not so much. And part of that is because we have systems that work hard and collaboratively with family members and professionals that really believe in this. But we are running into the barrier of the silos and individual funding streams. I can tell you I've worked quite a few years with families at the individual level trying to get help for them, and I have had experience after experience across the state with family members running into child welfare saying, well, we can't step in and do this because this really isn't an issue that's related to child welfare. And developmental disability says, well, we can't step in and help fund this even though we think it's a good idea because this is really coming from their mental health issues. And mental health saying, well, I don't know if we can open up our funding here because we think this is coming from the developmental disability. And what's happening is we have professionals that want to make a difference and help, but they are so constrained and stuck in the rules and regulations around when they can pay for something and when they cannot, that we have a lot of finger pointing, and we have a lot of this child's a DD kid, this kid's a mental health kid, this is about their school stuff, instead of bringing people together. And what this bill will do is it will say enough of this already. We're going to give you guys permission to do this, now go do it. And we're not going to have any more finger-pointing, and we're going to step forward and say, these are our children. All of them are our children. So let's blend our braid funding, and let's make this happen. Because everyone around this table cares about the outcomes for this kid, but let's not let the rules and regulations and the silos of funding determine what happens with this child and this family. So that's what this bill does. So if you have any questions, but it's extremely important to families that we get this barrier knocked down, that we get, in a sense, get government kind of out of the situation and let people have the permission to move forward and to do what's right at the local level for these children without being constrained with all the things that we have been, and especially the funding silos.
Okay. Thank you very much. Questions? Comments? Okay.
Chair Morissette and members of the committee, my name is Terry Dickens, and I'm the Director of Early Childhood Special Ed for Region 1 in Oregon, which is mainly the eastern Oregon counties. And we have been attempting to implement a wraparound process. process in our county and are finding it very difficult. And I would agree with what Jamie said in that we have a lot of very dedicated individuals who would do anything to provide the right services for this child. Often we have 8 dedicated individuals around a table, and we can't do anything, the specific thing.
Now, which county are you from?
Umatilla.
Umatilla, okay. Mm-hmm.
But I represent Umatilla, Morrow, Union, Baker, Wallawa, and Malheur.
Okay, good. Go ahead.
And Grant. I just lost my time.
I'm sorry that I interrupted.
Often we have a lot of adults around the table who would really like to help, including the parent, but each one of them can only do their piece. And I think that that breaking down the funding barriers and also just the cultural barrier that, you know, mental health can't do that because DD has to do that, is a very needed process. I think it gives back some of the family voice. I watched one of the parents that testified today go through this process and, quite frankly, took a child that was at the end of the foster care. Nobody would take that child at that time because of the difficulties that she faced. And this parent has taken it on, and she's far too modest in talking to you about what she's done because it's been nothing short of a miracle. She has seen this child through amazing difficulty. And while this child still has some issues, I can't imagine what she would have looked like had she not had this incredibly dedicated family who was willing to continue to fight all of the agencies. And I'm one of the agencies that she's talking about. It has not been easy for her to navigate the system and make sure that these agencies work together. And as an agency person, I can tell you that I'm absolutely guilty of that. It's one of my things, too. And so I believe that the wraparound House Bill 2144 is a step in the right direction in giving these parents some of the access that they need to be able to more adequately care for these very affected youth.
Okay. So you don't see this as a duplication of services? You see it as a cost saving, perhaps?
I think there are some duplications of services that already exist, and I believe that I don't even know if it will save any costs. I know that it will allow us to do more with the money that we have. We're not probably going to lay off any staff in this process, but we may be able to keep the staff on, reduce the turnover, because those staff feel more effective when they're working with these very high needs kids.
Okay. Questions?
Oh. Gentleman to call.
Okay.
Caller.
Yes, we have gentleman Dale Short from Coos County. I'd like to give testimony. Jane Ellen, would you come back, please? Mr. Short, this is Senator Bill Morissette. You wanted to give testimony on House Bill 2144. We're in committee right now. Are you ready to testify?
Yes, sir, I am. Thank you for your call.
Yes, go ahead and introduce yourself, please, for the record.
Yes, sir, my name is Dale Short. I'm a foster care parent affiliated with Scholastic Coastline, Coos County Foster Parents.
Okay.
I've been in the foster care, first of all, thank you for listening to me today. I've been in the foster care area for close to 10 years now, and it's only that after I moved to the coast of Oregon that I became aware of some of these things that we're going to call collaborative problem solving or collaborative approach. HB 2144 will allow access, will allow agencies to work closely together to provide wraparound care for recipients and their families, no matter who is leading any particular agency. All DHS, mental health, child protection, all these agencies are established with resources available to Oregon's children. However, many children do not access the resources easily because of roadblocks between agencies and between the children and their care. For instance, mental health recipients may have trouble accessing resources set aside for special ed. Likewise, special ed recipients may be blocked from receiving, pardon me, resources set aside for mental health, medical, or psychiatric care. H.R. 2144 does not create new resources. My understanding is it only makes resources already available to needy children more accessible to them and their families. I've seen the effects of this collaborative approach in my own home firsthand. The single case that I'm speaking of is a young girl who came to my home after 30-some-odd placements in the past 6 or 7 years. It's only after nearly a full year of this collaborative approach of wraparound care and many roadblocks that we had to go around or tear down, that the progress this young woman has made is astounding. In closing, I'd like to thank you for listening to me today and state once more that House Bill 2144 will allow a collaboration that does not occur today. It will tear down roadblocks between agencies and allow a more smooth flow of care through services and supports that already exist to individuals and their families who are in dire need of these resources. Again, I thank you for listening to me today.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's see if there are any questions or comments. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Short.
Thank you very much, sir.
Okay. Jane Ellen, would you like to sum up?
Chair Morissette and members of the committee, Jane Ellen Whiteans with Addictions and Mental Health Division. Thank you for hearing House Bill 2144 again today. I think that the stories that the families have told you and why they support this bill really epitomizes why state agencies support this bill as well. We want to work together. We have been working together. We've been making great progress. The leaders in child care throughout the state are doing wonderful things. This bill continues to hold their feet to the fire to remove those barriers so kids get the services that they need. There is no fiscal impact in this biennium because we're going to continue the work that we're doing. And if there is a need for additional funding in the future for data systems, for additional services, those will come back to the legislature through policy option packages and the reports that are mandated in partnership with an advisory council and the Department of Human Services and the cooperative agencies that are in the bill. So it is really breaking down those barriers, working together, and reporting back to you so that we're accountable for those actions. So we hope we have your support today. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Yes. Senator Verger.
Yes, thank you very much. I listen to these beautiful families who have really been placed with lots of challenges, and I think this is a very sad commentary on state government, to be honest with you. I'm not sure why we have to mandate people working together. I hear about silos, and I hear about funding streams, and I hear about all of that, but I still wonder what has happened that is placing for the good of all. Why, if these agencies are all around the table, and that they, you talk about these silos, but there's nothing that prevents them from reaching out and being collaborative in the working. I think there must be a far more serious problem here, and I'm not there, and I'm not inside of those walls, so I don't know what it is, and I haven't been in those meetings. I believe if I had been, I would be able to sense what some of the problems are, but I think it is a very sad commentary. I have some real concerns, and maybe you'd like to address them. The funding does not change for those agencies during the wraparound. They're going to continue to get the same amount of funding. Let me give you several things, and you can probably put it all into one. The funding would not change. I don't know that we can mandate behavior, so I don't know how you think we are going to change the finger pointing as well. And then the biggest one for me is this fiscal. You're going to have an implementation of collaboration. There's going to be a lot of changing, And in 11-13, it's very likely that our budget will be either as dire as it is today or worse. And so coming back with policy option packages or whatever in 11-13 is as concerning to me as it would be if you were here asking for a lot of increase in funding today. So going back, especially on the funding and the implementation and the cost, I don't know why we don't have a fiscal on this.
Chair Morissette and Senator Verger, the reason we don't have a fiscal on it is because of the governor's executive order brought the agencies together to start the work on this. Agencies acknowledged the problems, and the governor's office directed the agencies to work together to resolve those problems. And it's, I don't want to point fingers at anybody because that's not what this is about, but really what happens is agencies develop cultures, laws, and regulations, and federal requirements all develop a culture. And what this does is says we're going to break down those cultural barriers, those expectations of I do this this way and I do this this way, and this is my expertise, so I'm going to do the best I possibly can for this family in my little area. And it says we're going to all come to the table and work together. And the reason there is no fiscal this biennium, this coming biennium, is because we're going to continue to use existing state resources to work together. So the staff that are assigned to this have other duties and other expectations as well, but what they're going to do is actually sit together and figure out how to use state resources more appropriately, both at a state level, and help local communities access those state resources collaboratively instead of in competition or in duplication. And the I understand the concerns about 2011-2013 as well. We think that there are continuing things that the state can continue to do, and having the statute on the book makes sure that agencies don't backslide. It makes sure that no matter who is in the leadership position at education, at Department of Human Services, Oregon Youth Authority, the Commission on Children and Families, and in the governor's office, we continue to move forward. And there will be always be things we can do to improve without additional resources. And I think that that's what you're going to see in that report in 2011, is that we can do things that work together without additional fiscal impacts. There may be things that local communities are going to ask us for, and then we'll have to, as a state, and through the agency request budget and the governor's recommended budget, put forward a proposal if that comes to pass, and then it'll be up to the legislature to decide if that's something that they want to prioritize or not. But I think that there will always be things we can do to improve what we're doing at a state level, and this law basically says you're going to do that, and we want you to do that. The other thing that we think it will do is federal funding sources are actually supportive of this concept. The federal government has said that they support this, and this concept, and are encouraging states to do this. So we think it also sets us up for additional federal resources that may be available in the future for specific grants for local communities and at the state level.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Just to give you a little background, I worked with Easter Seal for 15 years raising funds for children and families with disabilities. And so my heart is with the challenges that they go through. And obviously children that are trying to get agency help and the family need help. Mm-hmm. And so I guess I'm wondering a couple of things. The governor has brought you in and encouraging agencies to do this. Was that not enough?
Chair Morissette, Senator Verger, I think that what we're saying is that we have acknowledged ongoing barriers and problems and silos that need continued work, even with the executive order. The executive order expired, and all of the stakeholders involved said what we want is legislation that keeps you at the table. So this wasn't just state agencies coming up with this bill. This was families and all of the organizations working to Oregon Wraparound to really, they said, we want legislation so that this doesn't go by the wayside. It doesn't fade regardless of who's in the leadership positions on it. So we're moving forward. We will continue to move forward. The bill just doesn't ever let us ignore that this is a critical issue we need to spend the time focusing on.
Okay, I need to say a few more remarks, Mr. Chairman. this is in no way to despair the work that our state employees do, who work extremely hard. And but if they are indeed working in a vacuum, and they can't seem to, either by rule or by culture, reach out and help families that really need help, if I vote for this bill, am I just saying in a loud voice that this is unacceptable? Or am I just voting for a bill that says, please come together and play well together?
Chair Morissette, Senator Verger, I think it actually says both. It says it's unacceptable for state agencies to make families jump through hoops and to try to find resources. It's the state agency's responsibility to help local communities, help those families and those children. And so I think it says that that's your intent, is that we will continue to break down those barriers and work to improve the system for families and kids. I also think it says play nice. And you will play nice, because we've told you you have to. And unfortunately, and I don't mean this in any derogatory way for state employees, both at the state level or in local communities and those providers, because everybody is working very, very hard. Oftentimes, when you're especially dealing with individuals in crisis, as you know from your work with children with disabilities and their families, is you get trapped in the current day and looking beyond just solving this one problem that's before you today. You need that loftier goal, and I think that's what this bill really is a loftier goal and the mandate that we continue to move forward.
Thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chair.
Would you like to talk about the grant money that Deschutes County will be receiving, because they have come together in a consortium, and that the federal government is rewarding Oregon for working together on medical assistance?
I think you did it.
Oh.
I will say Deschutes County is very forward-thinking and getting things done and working together, and it's a great county to be from.
Very good. And what I'm referring to is we've had a couple of informational hearings on 100% access in Lane County, and what's the name of your
Health Matters?
Health Matters in Deschutes County, and this is an example of the medical community coming together and sharing not only information but services to provide much needed enhanced services to people who can't afford it. And in a time of crisis, we're trying to close some of these gaps and work together to make our resources go further and provide more services. This is exactly what I see the wraparound doing at a different level. And I think, and you mentioned federal funding, I think that's what they're going to be looking at. States that have programs that will close some of those gaps and work together to provide enhanced services will be in line for the funding. And I think we've talked about this for our health care reform. We're in sync with the federal government in terms of health care reform. That's one of the bills, the Senate Bill 2009, that we're working on. And so the name of the game right now, I think, is to consolidate and to close, you know, get rid of the silos and close the gaps and do a better job with the resources that we have. And I think this is doing that, just as the 100% access is doing it, and just as our health care reform. So that's where I am. Other comments? Okay, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill House Bill 2144. And open a work session on House Bill 2144.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2144 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2144 to the floor with the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Comments? Would you call the roll, please?
Senator Montanus.
Aye.
Senator Verger.
Aye.
Senator Telford.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
Chair
Marquette. Aye. House Bill 2144 goes to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Who would like to carry the bill? I'll carry the bill. Okay, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2123, Department of Human Services, to report to the Legislative Assembly on staff. Oh, you say that.
Statute to do this.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2123A was originally heard on the 4th of May. It directs the Department of Human Services to report to each regular session of the legislature on staff workload, workload efficiency, and staffing needs in the areas of child welfare, temporary assistance for needy families, nutritional assistance, vocational rehabilitation services, medical assistance, and assistance to senior and disabled services. Subsequent to that meeting, we do have a Dash 2 amendment, which adds specifying language that the department shall report to all legislative relevant committees data regarding department employees in specified classified positions to include position vacancies and double-filled positions. There's a no revenue impact statement on the Dash 2 amendments, and a fiscal statement has been issued on those amendments. It indicates there's no fiscal impact.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'm satisfied with that the amendments accomplished what we had asked.
Okay, I don't have anyone.
No, there's no one scheduled.
Let's just go into work session
okay.
And do this.
We will open a work session on House Bill 2123.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash A2 amendment to House Bill 2123.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2123. Discussion?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I just think it's a shame that we have to have statutory enabling statutes that say be accountable to the legislature as to what you're doing. I mean, you know, you'd think these kinds of reporting, this kind of data collection would be an ongoing occurrence.
I think sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't, and I'm not comfortable with administrative rules necessarily, because they change as directors change, as people come and go, and I think statutory language is often required to keep people doing what they're probably doing right now but may not be doing next year. I mean, people come and people go and so on. Other comments?
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I just wanted to comment that I am very, very pleased with the amendment.
Okay. That
clarifies much better my concern.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Okay, we're voting on the amendment, so would you call... Okay, any objection to the amendments? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2123 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2123 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Would you call the roll, please?
Senator Moss.
Aye.
Senator Berger.
Aye.
Senator Telfair.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
Chair Marshall.
Aye. Senate Bill 2123, House Bill 2123 will go to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and Senator Cruz will carry the bill. Seeing how you're so pleased with it. Okay, we have one more bill, and we will have a discussion on, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2124. Do we have anyone here to testify?
No.
No one is here to testify. Patty O'Sullivan, would you please come
forward? We're moving right along here, you know?
No, we'll tell you what when you get here. Yes.
What happens when you come back in?
I've been waiting to do that for 6 years.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2124 was originally heard on the 4th of May. It changes the name of the food stamp program to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program in accordance with federal statutory changes. It updates the references to the Food Stamp Act of 1977 to the Food and Nutrition Act, and it allows the program beneficiaries to receive benefits as a check or direct deposit rather than a debit card. There's a no revenue impact statement issued and a no fiscal impact statement. We do have a Dash A2 amendment. It's a conflict resolution amendment, and it deletes the definition by reference of food stamp plan and adds a definition by reference to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. So we would need to adopt that amendment.
We need to have, would you come up, please? And give us a compelling reason why we should do this.
Please.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, I'm Vic Todd, administrator for the Office of Self-Sufficiency within the Children's Families. Lost my train of thought there. Department of Human Services. This bill really follows the changes to the federal law that changed the name of the food stamp program to Supplemental Nutrition Assistance. And so this is basically going through all of the statutes and replacing those names.
Well, we had a meeting with the director of DHS the other day over a different issue, but he referred to this program as food stamps twice.
That's true.
Yep. Everybody will. Mm-hmm. They still will.
I'm thinking food coupons or food nutrition
snap coupons.
Mr. Chairman, yep. Could he say a little bit more about the amendment, please?
Oh, yeah, the amendment. We have a dash.
It's a conflict amendment resolution by legislative council has indicated that there was a conflict with another statute, and so it's just changing the definition by reference, so it's called, everything is being called with the same name, so it's just putting in line other names, program names, so they're all the same.
Okay, so the Jobs Plus program was in the original bill. It's not added in the amendment.
2124. What?
The only conflict that legislative council found in a different statute is relative to the name of the food stamp program and changing that name. So that's the only thing that they were dealing with in the amendment.
Chair Morissette,
yes.
Senator Berger, it has no impact on programs at all. It merely is just changing the name.
Yeah. Okay. Senator Cruz, would you like to weigh in on this heavy issue?
On this heavy issue?
We have 15 minutes to discuss this, and we're going to take every... No, we won't.
We're going to do our organizational meeting.
Mr. Chair, I don't see the need to change the name. From something that everybody knows at a time when more people are going to be accessing services, and then we're going to call it something else. The food stamp program is the food stamp program. Now, clearly, Mr. Chair, the food stamp program has issues, which we talked about yesterday in Senator Mona Sanderson's committee in relation to obesity. And I fully understand that, and there's a lot of work needs to be done, but that work will be done no matter what it's called. And I just like the food stamp program, and I don't want to change the name, pure and simple.
Any other comments?
Okay. Actually, let me say something, okay. Too. You know, change is tough. And we have scope of practice things that change is tough. But I do think that SNAP is a catchy phrase. SNAP program rather than food stamps. Food stamps does have a culture that, and it is focusing on nutrition, which we really need to be making some major changes, I think. Regarding obesity in particular. So
you think changing the name might help to change the culture? That would be...
Maybe.
That's kind of language.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Okay. I actually was home recently, and my constituents picked up on this. And it gets kind of ridiculous, but the Humane Society has an acronym, SNAP, which
food stamp
means a lot different things, spay and neuter, but a lot of nonprofits that have an acronym that's SNAP, and I just don't know.
Senator Cruz, would you please pay attention?
I'm not sure this is an acronym that I want to...
She's just...
I have a problem with an acronym, among other things, in that in the Humane Society it's SNAP, it's spay and neuter program, but so I have a problem with the acronym in itself, but my constituents coming back from being home think this is ridiculous to change the name. I concur with you. It'll always be called food stamps, no matter how hard we try to change this.
You know, Mr. Chair, in the tough economic times we are in, that we're putting the focus on a name change from a program. I just can't support this. No, it's your call on what we do. I understand the need for the A2 for the conflict, or just the cleanup. It's not conflict, but this makes no sense to me.
Okay. Senator Berger, does it make sense to you?
Body language.
Well, you know,
says
a
everything.
Rose by any other name is a rose.
Okay.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, I think it's important to note that we have not issued food stamps for 12 years.
Yeah.
It's all done through electronic benefits transfer. Mm-hmm. And one of the purposes of changing the name of the program to Supplemental Nutrition Assistance is that very fact, that they are not issued as coupons, and it is more that focus towards nutrition and health. In terms of where the program is moving. So that's what it's trying to reflect.
Now, the Oregon Trail card is what people receive, right?
Mm-hmm. Chair Morissette, that's correct.
So why don't we call it the Oregon Trail card?
This is a nutrition program. Yeah. It truly is a nutrition program.
I would submit that, no, it's still a food stamp program. We'd like it to be a nutrition program, but it's not. It's a food stamp program.
But this is the beginning of it becoming a nutrition
program.
Well,
I think you change the thing before you change the name.
Mm,
so.
Not necessarily.
Yes, Patty, please, come up.
Yes, we are. For the record, my name is Patricia O'Sullivan. I'm with DHS. It's something popped into my brain. I just wanted to say, and
that's scary.
I know that is scary, Senator. It's first time too. But you know, we used to call welfare welfare, and it had a connotation that, and people were sort of on welfare, like kind of cyclical forever, and for families. And we changed it to TANF, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. And I know, just kind of being out there in the DHS world, that people call it TANF. They don't call it welfare anymore. And it took a long time. And so I don't disagree that people will call it food stamps, but a food stamp is a thing. And a supplemental nutritional program is a program. And hopefully we can move towards and making it be what we want it to be. So I understand your hesitance, and it does seem silly and bureaucratic, but if we think of it that way and we go back to what welfare used to be and what it stood for, and TANF came in before people started thinking of it as temporary assistance, and it became that program, I think maybe you might see it in a little bit different light, or maybe not. We'll see in just a couple minutes.
Okay. Yes,
thank
will.
You.
Well, you convinced me. I'll open a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash A2 amendment to House Bill 2124.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves the dash two amendments to House Bill 2124. Objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Yes?
There you go. Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, move House Bill 2124 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2124 to the floor with the due pass, Senate floor with the due pass recommendation. Comment.
Mr. Chair, this is just another silly PC thing we're doing.
Actually, it's interesting because I've always felt that if you have a public hearing, you keep an open mind until you hear the last testimony. And that did it for me.
No,
yeah. I think the idea. Let me tell you why I said that, because we're talking about nutrition. And making food stamps into more of a nutritional program.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about, or was brought to our attention, that the TANF program replaces welfare, the concept, the word welfare. And I think that words have an intrinsic value, and they determine how we feel about things. And I think welfare is that thing that we're trying to we're trying to get people, make people more responsible, give them temporary assistance so they get off of welfare. We just carried a bill, I carried a bill that we passed through the committee concerning 1% of the people who go to college on TANF will continue to go to college. So I think we've succeeded in that area. We may succeed, I think, in this area to change the culture, we change the name. So I think that's...
Mr. Chair, we changed from welfare to TANF because the feds did.
I know. Well, the feds did this, too. And we're following the federal lead, and I think maybe if we do want to make it into a more nutritional program, we incorporate that idea into the title.
So we're assuming the feds know what they're doing?
Sometimes they do, and sometimes they don't. Okay, would you call the roll, please?
Senator Monsanto?
Aye.
Senator Berger?
Aye.
Senator Telfer?
No.
Vice Chair Cruz?
No. Chair Morrison? Aye. Senator Monsanto, would you carry the bill? Okay. Senator Monsanto will carry the bill.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
That was our last bill.
Uh-huh. We have one more item on the agenda.
We have one more item, but that was the last bill. And I just wanted to, as your vice chair, it has been once again an honor to serve with you. And your willingness to be collaborative is exemplary. I would say it's only matched by that of the other committee I'm vice chair of, that's Senator Mona Sanderson's committee. So good job, and thank you for your leadership.
Well, thank you for your leadership as well. I appreciate that. And I think the committee has been wonderful and fun to work with. Okay, the last item. Pardon me?
This is the end of my first committee, so don't we have cake?
The end of the
As soon as we get rid of the rest of Senate Bill 10, we can do that again.
Okay, we do have one more item that I would like us to deal with, and this is a direction, a directive that I would like the committee to make to the Board of Massage Therapists, and the wording is: prior to the 2011 legislative session, the State Board of Massage Therapists shall contract with a private consultant who will provide a report to the appropriate interim committee, and the report would detail the modalities licensed by the board, number of providers within each modality, and why it is in the public's best interest for those modes to be regulated by the board. A comparison of how other states regulate the modes, a plan for regulating some modes as distinct and different from licensed massage therapists with separate education and exam requirements, and suggested changes to administrative rules that will establish a clear delineation of what providers and techniques are and are not regulated by the Oregon Board of Massage Therapy. Prior to the 2011 legislative session, the State Board of Massage Therapists shall report, readopt administrative rule changes made in the 2008 or newly amend rules with regard to license exam to be used for licensure in Oregon. The rulemaking process shall include public notification of rulemaking, public hearing, acceptance of letters from the public, open board discussion of adoption of rules, and public notification of final decisions. Now, this is, I actually received this from Cindy Roberts, who is the lobbyist who represents the therapist, not the board, but the therapist, who has sat through many of our meetings, had some disagreements with both the committee and with the board of therapist, and felt that being kind of on the inside of what's going on, she made some suggestions that I feel would help us when we come back in 2011, because we have been asked by the board to change, to exempt people from their from being regulated by them. Now, let's let them review this before they come back to us. Discussion.
Sure, I'm wondering if we don't have something for February rather than 2011.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that we could change it to February.
I just really need to change the correct the spelling.
I know
it.
Yeah, I was reading through it aloud. Yeah.
Acceptance. Hearings is misspelled.
I know.
And so
okay.
It's acceptance.
Okay. Okay.
Rules, please.
Okay. This. Okay. This is the email that I received, and I guess I should have gone through that first. But in reading it, I realized that there was some glitches here.
You have all three marked.
Other comments.
BNC.
Mr. Chair, I really, really would like the massage therapy board to be a part of this. I know you want Cindy to be it, but...
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Cindy, because I think there are massage therapists that aren't a part of the association also, so we can't rely totally on one organization. For instance, we have the Oregon Nurses Association, but we also have... another nursing organization under AFT, and so there are a number of us that are, you know, there's conflicts between those two organizations, and so I know there's conflicts between all of these modalities in under massage therapy, and you do have the massage therapists, but then you have those reflexologists, and you have, oh, I forget what the names of the others that we dealt with, so... I feel it's necessary for this to happen, but I truly want it to be inclusive, and hopefully everyone who has an interest will be at the table.
Okay. The conflict arises when the board, when these different modalities come to us saying that they should not be part of the massage therapy under their jurisdiction, and they make some compelling arguments, and but we're caught trying to decide what's best when really that discussion should take place beforehand, as you have said. So I would hope that it would be inclusive of all of the people who... What I envision, I think that a lot of the people who will be involved are those people who arbitrarily are under the domain of the massage therapy board, and they don't think they are. There were three groups that we didn't hear who came to us, and the reflexologists are still not completely happy because they feel that the board still considers part of the techniques used by the reflexologist as the domain of the massage therapy board, and they have to figure that out.
Mr. Chair, a lot of that can be handled in definition, I really think. I mean, if you read definition, that is what includes them. If we modify definition to exclude them, then they don't fall under the purview. So, I mean, it's a lot of wordsmithing there, but it's something potentially we could do. And I guess one of my issues at this point is this ask the board to readopt administrative rules before 2011, which I'm thinking if that's the time frame they're on, why can't we revisit the issue in February when we're here?
Saying no later than 2011, so that if they're ready to address it.
You know, if there's going to be changes made, we should have the ability to opine on them in February.
Let's include that then in the direction to the board, is that we would want to hear from them in February.
Mm-hmm. Sort of a progress report.
For a progress report,
yeah.
Right. And then that would clarify, misunderstandings that might exist in terms of the direction. So, Senator Verger will work with our administrative staff to make sure that the grammar and spelling is correct.
Libra.
writing.
Oh.
That wasn't my writing.
I know it wasn't. Okay. So, I guess
we're done.
We're done.
Good job.
Thank you. Thank you.